We're going to start with a Genjo koan ends with a koan. And we're going to start this session with that koan. And you're not going to read it. You're going to watch it.
Master, the nature of wind is permanent, and there is no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself?
Although you understand that the nature of wind is permanent, you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere.
What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere?
Thank you. We'll read the last part in a bit. So there's a phrase, Buddha nature pervades the whole universe, existing right here and now. That phrase is used in some Zen centers in their dedication at the end of a service, chanting service. Buddha nature pervades the whole universe, existing right here and now. So that's the wind. The wind is that Buddha nature pervading the whole universe. To understand this koan that you just saw so beautifully reenacted, it might be helpful to look into a little bit into the background of this concept of Buddha nature. Is it something that has changed? And I'm grateful to Shohaku Okamura's commentary for helping me with this. It's a very fine resource. In early Buddhism, there was a word called, Tathagatagarbha. And it was used for the teaching that each sentient being contains the seed of Buddhahood. Tathagata is one of the names of the Buddha. It just refers to the Buddha, and it means kind of literally, thus come one. Thus come one, Tathagata. And garbha means womb or embryo. So it's referring to like a kind of embryonic, referring to us as kind of embryonic Buddhas, right? The term implies a gestational period, right, during which we grow and mature into Buddhas. And as it was understood in early Buddhism, that took countless lifetimes. The famous analogy is the diamond in the rough, covered in impurities, that must be polished and polished and polished to remove the impurities through our practice to reveal its true nature. However, this whole theory has always been a bit problematic in Buddhist philosophy and the way it's sometimes presented, because it can seem to imply the existence of Atman, kind of the Hindu version of soul, a pure spiritual essence apart from the body, which would continue from one lifetime to the next through rebirth, transmigration. And the Buddha clearly taught that there is no enduring self, spiritual or material. If there's no self, what is there to transmigrate? But a change in understanding evolved in Mahayana Buddhism. The term Buddha nature was first used synonymously with the Tathagatagarbha, or Buddha womb, Buddha embryo, in an early Mahayana sutra called the Mahayana Parinirvana Sutra in the first century. In a statement, all living beings without exception have Buddha nature. That's a statement hundreds of years later. Dogen then tweaked once more into all Buddhas, all living beings are Buddha nature. A later Mahayana text called Awakening Faith in the Mahayana, which scholars believe to have originated in China, taught that mind has two aspects, the absolute and the relative, which we talked about yesterday and again today. The absolute and the relative, the one and the many, the unitary and the particular, which are both simultaneous and mutually inclusive. And as we saw yesterday, Dogen sets out that that concept of the relative and the absolute in the first two lines of the Genjo Koan. And then in the third line, he sets out what he calls a leaping beyond into beyond relative and absolute, or relative and absolute interpenetrating. So this teaching, relative and absolute, forms the basis for the concept of Hongaku, or original enlightenment, which corresponds to the absolute. You know, like we all implicitly are Buddha nature. We are all one, like a vast ocean. And then waves of our karmic lives arise, and sometimes they get stormy, and sometimes they smooth out. Waves and Waters is the name of the Sangha who meets here on Thursday night in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh. It's referring to that metaphor of the waves and the ocean. The waves of samsara, the waves of our karmic lives. So according to that concept of original enlightenment, it's due to our own ignorance, our ignorance, our greed, our obstructions, that we lose sight, our dharma eye is not open, it's obstructed, we lose sight of we can't see our true nature, so we need to practice to realize and actualize our true nature in our everyday phenomenal existence. So that process is called shikaku, actualized enlightenment. Don't worry about these terms, but get a sense of this dichotomy that's not really a dichotomy. Because I believe that Dogen is persuading us that these two, original enlightenment and actualized enlightenment, are in fact mutually inclusive, interpenetrating. That's, I think, what he's convincing us of in Genjo Koan. But in China, these two perspectives became the basis for a very famous extended debate between the Northern and Southern schools, who staked out their claim as so often is the case in the world of science, academics, and religion, of staking out turf and drawing the boundary and saying we're right, and those guys over there haven't got it right. The Southern school emphasized original enlightenment, and the Northern school emphasized actualized enlightenment. And they came to be stereotyped as the sudden and gradual schools. The sudden school requiring rigorous practice to induce a kind of sudden, direct experience of awakening called Kensho. And you hear about it more hear that word more in Rinzai Zen, where the particular meditation technique or a particular technique used is to focus on a koan as object of meditation to break through into an experience of emptiness, boundlessness, seeing our true nature. And then the gradual school, relying on steady practice that over time clears away obstructions to reveal the Buddha nature that is there all along. So Rinzai and Soto Zen are typically characterized or stereotyped in this way. Although, apparently often in Chinese monasteries, people were doing a variety of practices, including devotional practices as well as these practices. So it wasn't such a hard and fast line. But to this day, it's too easy for zealots on either side to stereotype. You know, for people to say, oh, those Rinzai people, they're strivers, they're type A Zen people, right? But then once they have an experience, they think that's it. They think they're somebody, right? and then on the other side to say, oh, those Soto people, they're slackers. They don't know what true enlightenment is. But I don't think Dogen has much patience for that sort of thinking. And he actually refers to the sudden and gradual debate in another text, but I don't have it at my fingertips. This debate is exemplified in the story of the search for a successor, for the fifth Zen ancestor. When we talk about the first, second, third ancestors, they're dating generationally from Bodhidharma, who brought Zen practice from India to China. So when you hear this first, second, third ancestor, that's what they're referring to. So this is the fifth Zen ancestor, Daman Hongren, late 7th century China. And he hadn't decided who would be his successor, so he asked his monks to write a poem to express their understanding of the Dharma and to post the poem on the wall. So his senior disciple posted this poem. The body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is like a bright mirror's stand. At all times we must strive to polish it and must not let dust collect. So that poem describes pretty much the practice of the gradual school, slowly polishing away at the dust of delusion over many years. He was pretty confident that his poem was going to win. But there was an illiterate layman, often said to be a woodcutter, named Huineng, who was working at the monastery. And there's a much bigger story, but that I can't tell you about him now. But he asked another monk if he could write his poem in response, because he was illiterate. So his poem was written and posted. His poem was, Bodhi originally has no tree. The bright mirror also has no stand. Fundamentally, there is not a single thing. Where could dust arise? So he's coming from the absolute, the perspective, you know, of emptiness, of boundlessness, and he's referring to a sudden, direct experience of that. So-called sudden enlightenment. So the story goes that the fifth ancestor was so impressed, he decided to give the succession to Huineng, but actually, he was afraid there would be an uprising if he gave his succession to this illiterate woodcutter. So he sent Huineng into kind of seclusion or sent him off wandering and then brought him back years later. But that's a long story. And these days, scholars pretty much consider it to be apocryphal that this story about the poems was created to build Huineng's reputation. So it's questionable whether he ever even wrote the poem. But it gives you a flavor of the debate. So Huineng became the sixth ancestor, and his Dharma heir was Nanyue. And Nanyue and his disciple Mazu appear in a koan that Dogen presents at the end of a chapter of the Shobo Genzo called Old Mirror. There's a whole chapter that's all stories about mirrors. We might do that one. That would be fun to do sometime. and so this koan is at the end of that chapter, and we will have another reenactment. Yeah. Okay, so this time you go visit him. You guys can turn around and watch.
Zazen. What do you intend by doing Zazen?
Intending to become a Buddha. Master, what are you doing?
Polishing a tile.
Why are you polishing the tile?
I'm trying to make a mirror.
How can you polish a tile to make a mirror?
How can you do Zazen to become a Buddha?
What do you mean?
Think about driving a cart. When it stops moving, do you whip the cart or the horse? Do you want to practice sitting Zen or sitting Buddha? If you understand sitting Zen, you will know that Zen is not about sitting or lying down. If you want to learn sitting Buddha, know that sitting Buddha is without any fixed form. Do not use discrimination in the non-abiding Dharma. If you practice sitting as Buddha, you must kill Buddha. If you are attached to the sitting form, you are not yet mastering the essential principle.
Thank you. That was great. So you've probably heard that expression, killing the Buddha, before. And of course what that means is killing your idea, being attached to your idea of the Buddha or enlightenment. And so this koan, like Huineng's poem, might typically be construed as a critique of the gradual approach. You know, he's trying so hard to polish his practice. But Dogen, however, does not actually accept this sort of polarized view. He loves to turn the classic koans upside down and inside out. It's sitting Zazen with the goal of enlightenment as an endpoint that he questions, not the practice itself. He actually says we still need to polish the tile. He says, without polishing a tile, how can a great sage have the skillful means to make a true person? So coming back to Genjo Koan, you know, we have to actualize our practice ongoing. The American teacher, Zen teacher John Daido Lori, wrote a commentary on Dogen's collection of 300 koans. Remember I said Dogen brought back, copied 300 koans when he was in China and brought them back. But He didn't write a commentary in the style of the other, like the Blue Cliff Record or the Mumon Khan, the Gateless Gate, where this typical form is, you know, the koan is presented, and then a commentary, and then a verse by the commentator. Dogen didn't do it in that way. His commentaries on the koans are contained in his writing, in Shobo Genzo. There's lots and lots of his commentaries on koans in there. But John Daido Lori did a very brave thing for an American Zen teacher. He took those 300 koans of Dogen's and wrote his own commentary and verse to go with them. And his commentary on this koan says, "The reality of the universe fills your body and mind, yet it is not manifested without practice, nor is it realized without enlightenment." So practice enlightenment. Hand in hand, interpenetrating. He goes on, "Unless you are prepared to move forward and take risks, the truth of your life and of the universe is never realized as this very life itself." Sort of like what Dogen was saying this morning is, you know, if we kind of hold back and think, well, we can't really move unless we, you know, we really fully understand, or we're more perfect bodhisattvas, or we're better, or our zazen's better. We're always holding back. We're separating ourselves from our actual moment-to-moment experience, and it's in that experience that we practice and we awaken. So going on another generation, so Nanyue's disciple Mazu, who was the guy who was, you know, trying so hard over there, he went on to become a renowned Zen master himself, featured in many stories from the koan literature. And he had quite a few Dharma heirs. And so he and his disciples, his followers, are credited with the Chinese Zen's emphasis on awakening through penetrating the reality of Buddha nature in our daily lives, through a direct experience of our daily lives. This was kind of a new emphasis that came. And the valuing of everyday experience in the phenomenal world as Dharma gates. That's Dharma gates. These teachers generated such famous sayings as mind itself is Buddha, and everyday mind is the way. Everyday mind is the way is one that's we're fond of in our everyday Zen family of sanghas, and Norman Fisher chose to use that phrase for his community, you know, forming a kind of community of lay practice sanghas. So Mazu and his disciple, Mazu, one of those disciples of Mazu is Nanchuan, and his student Zhao Zhou are going to have an encounter next. So this is Nanchuan here.
What is the way?
Everyday mind is the way.
How should I direct myself toward it?
If you direct yourself toward it, you'll be going in the wrong direction.
But if I don't direct myself toward it, how can I know it?
The way has nothing to do with knowing or and not knowing. Knowing is an exaggeration. Not knowing is stupidity. When you enter the way, you see it as vast and boundless as space. What does this have to do with yes and no?
Zhao Zhou had sudden realization. I forget to tell you, the previous one, it says, Mazu felt as if he had tasted sweet nectar. They always have that lovely punchline. So thank you once again. He's still fanning.
This is how many things do Huskers be on tonight?
Yeah, this is better yet. So we'll come back to these three koans. But I would like to ask someone to read that final paragraph, or the second half of the final paragraph, from the actualization of Buddha Dharma. Like, look at number 14, skip over the koan, and from the actualization of the Buddha Dharma. Could someone read that who hasn't read yet? Thanks.
The actualization of the Buddha Dharma, the vital path of its correct transmission, is like this. If you say that you do not need to fan yourself because the nature of wind is permanent, and you can have wind without fanning, you will understand neither impermanence nor the nature of wind. The nature of wind is permanent. Because of that, the wind of the Buddha's house brings forth the gold of the earth and makes fragrant the green cream of the long river.
Thank you. The nature of wind is ever present. Because of that, the wind of Buddha's house brings forth the gold of the earth and makes fragrant the cream of the long river. These are quite beautiful images of our practice as nourishing, you know, beautiful and nourishing. Hakuin Zenji, in his Song of Zazen, which is a chant that we do once in a while here from the Rinzai tradition. He was an 18th century Japanese Rinzai teacher. The last lines in that poem are, this very land is the pure lotus land, this very body the Buddha. In any moment of opening to the boundless reality of life, this very land is the pure lotus land. The commentaries that I've read cite different possible sources for these images of gold and this river of milk. It's apparently an old Dogen didn't invent these. He's referring to a river of milk. It goes back to probably Indian lore. But what I find intriguing is the word that is translated here as cream, or elsewhere as sweet cream, or I even found one translation referred to it as cheese. the Chinese characters are sulao, soraku in Japanese, and it's a fermented milk drink called kumis, traditionally made of mare's milk and highly valued for its health properties in Central Asia. So I thought, I just love this idea of our practice as a fermentation process. That the raw material of our lives matures and ripens with age, offering nourishment to those around us. This is what growing up and becoming a mature human being and taking our place among the 10,000 things is. And if we don't maintain our practice and provide the conditions for it to continue, Michael knows about this. You know, if you don't maintain that sourdough starter, what happens? Right? Our practice can stagnate and go off like sour milk. It can stink. But fortunately, we can mix it up again. Rescue our sourdough starter or make a new one. Get some starter from someone else. No one can actualize your practice but you, in a way that only you can in this wild and precious life. We read the Mary Oliver poem this morning. For those who might have missed it, your wild and precious life. But we must always remember with awe and with gratitude that we only awaken within the matrix of all interdependent beings. So, we can give each other the gift of good company and encouragement on the path. And like the old Zen masters, we can give each other a nudge now and then so we don't get complacent. Or we'll get nudged anyway. So, that's where I'll stop now. And what I thought it would be fun to do is configure ourselves a little differently than how we've done so far, and have each group take one of these koans. So there's the Bao Jie fanning himself. There's Nanyue polishing the tile. It was probably a piece of roof tile that, you know, an old roof tile that fell off a roof. And he saw it lying there and he picked it up and started trying to polish it because those buildings all had roof tiles in those days. If they weren't, you know, thatched roofs. And then there's everyday mind is the way. I have copies of those to pass around to you. So you're gonna, I'm going to ask you to get in groups. And then each group, each person in the group, take a turn to just see, having spent all these 2 days with, or less for some of you, and with Dogen and Genjo Koan, to see how would Dogen view this koan? You know, how do you see Genjo Koan in this koan? And then how does it support your practice? What do you see here that supports your practice? So if you pass these around, then I'll ring a bell to start you. But I'm not going to ring the bell for each person this time. I'm going to give you I'm going to give you, you know, about 15 minutes for your... So you can each take a turn and then, you know, allow some time, a little time for discussion as well.
Afterwards?
Yeah, yeah. So each take a short, you know, a shortish turn and then some discussion. And then you can report back to the large group. So take a few minutes just to settle yourselves and review your koan. And then I'll ring the bell to start you. Once again, each person take a few minutes, no more, and then you can have some group discussion. I'll give you about 15 minutes altogether. Okay? Go ahead.